And now it's time for Stages.
Stages.
All the world's a stage.
It's where we talk about,
it's about all things
theatrical.
It's about theatre.
Theatre makers.
If it's performing on a stage, we've got it for you here on Stages.
It's about half an hour long.
Okay, let's get on with the show.
And that is our cue to get on with the show. Hello, hello. My name is CL. Welcome to Stages. I'm joined by the lovely Tricia Stars.
Hey, oh, thanks, Trish. CL. I'm very good. Looking forward to the show.
Absolutely. Well, you have gone to the STC, which is going to be fantastic. We're going to be hearing your thoughts on their play Avalanche coming up soon.
And we're going to talk to Catherine Van Davies. She's in the wonderful Titus Andronicus for Bell Shakespeare that's playing at the Opera House.
Also, the lovely Claudia Ware is going to be joining us. She's starring in The God of Isaac. Lots of good reviews about that play at the moment.
And Rod's doing a fantastic interview with Hilary Bell, the writer of Splinter, that's playing right now at the Griffin Theatre.
Oh my gosh, so much good theatre to talk about. So much good stuff to go and see, including this, Pearl the Girl. I'm a big fan of this band. They're playing at the Chippo on Friday night. Here is their song, I Hate You. I don't hate you.
Goddamn heartbreak. I like sex in the morning instead of breakfast. I like sympathy when it works for me. And shutting up my mouth when you're screaming. Well, the upper hand's just round the corner. Call it how it is. I tried to leave, but you made me stay. Now I fucking hate you. There's a space between my arms.
That was Pearl the Girl. I should have said language warning. Whoops. We are right now joined in the studio by the lovely Claudia Ware. She is starring as Shelley in The God of Isaac, as playing Isaac's wife. Hello, Claudia.
Hello. Thank you for having me in.
For everyone, give us an overview of what this play is all about.
Yeah, sure. So this play was written in the early 80s, but set in 77 in Skokie, Chicago, which at the time had the largest number of Holocaust survivors anywhere in the world.
Oh, wow.
So it's set against the backdrop of a real-life event where a group of neo-Nazis led by Frank Collin decided to protest, sort of a white supremacist protest. And this was prior to Holocaust survivors sort of starting to speak about their experiences. And at the forefront of all this is a young man, Isaac Adams, who is a second-generation Jew. Living in Chicago, but without any real connection to his Jewish heritage or his Jewish roots. And this event is sort of a catalyst for his journey of thinking, what does it mean to be a Jew? What does it mean to me to have a Jewish heritage? And he goes on this journey throughout the play.
It's really interesting that it was, you know, written in the 70s or early 80s and set then, and yet now we're seeing the real rise of the right all around the world.
Yes, absolutely. And even the conversations around free speech, particularly in our own country and in our own city, the conversations about Section 18C and issues with Israel Folau this year, and even it popped up in the election this year as well. And I think that all started back in 2016 with the potential watering down of that section, and lots of conversations about what role does the government play in protecting its citizens against discrimination, and they're questions that are asked in the play as well. You know, what's the best way forward, action or inaction? Fight against it, ignore it.
So you're pretty sure the play is still relevant then? It still sort of brings up issues?
Absolutely. Yeah, but I mean, the play is going to mean different things to different people.
Yeah.
Someone might watch this play and that theme be particularly salient for them, and other people might hear something quite different. So I think it's quite broad and exciting in that way.
And Shelley, your character, Shelley Claudia, I'm calling you by your character's name.
That's quite all right.
Your character is not Jewish and kind of not, would we say, overly thrilled by her partner's sort of foray back into his Jewish heritage.
Look, she's just thoroughly secular.
Right. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No. She, they have quite a quick courtship. They get married after 2 months. And like anyone who enters into a marriage, is quite surprised and relatively uncomfortable with discovering that the person she's married is seeking to be something other than what she signed up for.
This was not on the brochure.
This was not on the marketing scheme. And I think, I've certainly pushed away from making her obnoxiously resistant to his, his search for his Jewish identity. But certainly, in a secular brain, she just doesn't understand why it's so important and why it takes precedence over their marriage. And at the end of it all, they do split up because, as she says, they're just too different. Mm. But yes, I'm the only non-Jewish character in this play, so I'm definitely a foil to everybody else.
You're right.
And I hear that the mother actually sits in the audience. Is this
She certainly true? Does. So the mother is played by Annie Byron, who is a fantastic woman and a fantastic actor, and she sits in the audience. So anyone with an overbearing mother will be able to relate to that section of the play. But it's a really, I think, tasteful breaking of the fourth wall.
Yeah, it's a really interesting convention. Mm. I like that.
Yeah, and I think it's done really well and with a lot of warmth and skill, and certainly Lloyd, who sort of carries this show. I mean, you know, it's not a one-man show. We're ensemble, but he's on stage the whole time, and he does a nuanced, excellent job of navigating that convention, yet keeping the world of the play in its own bubble as well. So, yeah, it's an interesting...
And across the board, he's had great reviews. And also your director, she has had fabulous reviews as well for how she's handled this.
Yes, no, we've had some lovely feedback, both in print and... But I think the most rewarding part of this play has actually been chatting to people in the foyer. I don't think I've ever had such warm foyer conversations. Mm-hmm. It's we've had large Jewish and non-Jewish audiences.
I was going to say, is it attracting more of a Jewish audience? Or is
it is.
Yeah.
It is. And that has been... probably my favourite part of this process. They stick around in the foyer and they want to talk to you, and it is fascinating and interesting, and they're all reading the play in different ways. Mm. You know, not every single Jewish audience member is looking at it in the same way. They all have a different interpretation of it, but that's been wonderful. But also I've had a bunch of, you know, non-Jewish secular friends come that go, yeah, there was a lot of Jewish content, but also it's a play about identity. Mm-hmm. And it's a play about your roots, and, you know, we all grow up in a particular sort of moral, ethical, spiritual ecology, and whether we grow away from that or grow closer to that as time goes on remains pertinent to everyone. So, you know, friends and strangers who don't belong to the Jewish community have come out going, that was fantastic and interesting in its
really
own
interesting,
way. So,
yeah, because and also for immigrants, I mean, the immigrant experience is that, and sometimes you find in a diaspora in Australia or America that they're actually more hardcore than they are back in the old country, sort of thing, and that can happen, and then the generations fade away and then refind it. So all those things happen in places that have large immigration.
Yeah, and even on a kind of micro personal level, that process of sort of growing up into your teens, into your early 20s, moving away from your roots, kind of stretching it out, seeing its flexibility, and then hitting a point in your late 20s, early 30s, as Isaac does, and go, well, what did that mean? And to what degree should that be important in my life? There's a great line that Annie Byron, who plays the mother, says at the end of the play. I'm probably going to butcher it. She says, maybe the way we were Jewish wasn't the best way for you. But you should never forget where you came from, otherwise you won't know where you're going. I think that's really delicately written. It says, just because we gave you something doesn't mean you need to embrace it wholeheartedly, but it's worth acknowledging and looking, you know, look for the value in that and then move on from it.
And I imagine it must have been, you know, part of the plays would have been exploring that difficulty in that he's with a partner that is not Jewish and suddenly he is embracing his Jewishness, his Jewish heritage, and then wanting his partner to convert.
Yeah.
And then when the answer is no, that's really hard, having to choose between your love and, you know.
And your identity.
Yeah.
Essentially. For him, it's more than just picking a religion or picking a spirituality.
Oh, no. I didn't mean to imply that.
No, I know you weren't. But, you know, that at this point in his life, it's a real watershed moment of going, I need to choose who I am and who I want to be.
Right.
And can you be a part of that? And if you can't, then this relationship is just going to become corrosive.
Sure.
And that's, you know, they end up going their separate ways. And she too says, you're trying to take away my identity. So they're both firmly set. And she's an interesting woman, I think. It's, you know, it's set in 77, but James Sherman still writes a woman who says, don't ask me to skip out on my job. Don't ask me to skip out on my audition. I'm going to work and I earn money and, you know.
That's right. So especially in the 70s as well.
I know.
Just in that, you know, the zeitgeist of, you know, the feminist movement.
Yeah. So she's grounded in that identity. So it's tit for tat. They're both wanting to become encased in who they are at that point in their life.
So many fabulous issues to delve into and explore.
Absolutely.
And as I said, getting rave reviews all over the shop.
Yeah.
The God of Isaac is on to the 22nd of September at Darlinghurst Theatre. Make sure you get out and see it, whether you are Jewish or secular or anything else for that matter. Thank you so much for joining us, Claudia.
My absolute pleasure.
It's either friendship or lovers, but not the in-between.
And now we have Roderick Chambers interviewing the wonderful Hilary Bell, who's written yet another fabulous play called Splinter, which is being performed at the Griffin Theatre Company.
It's a two-hander. It's a kind of a very dark psychological thriller. It doesn't have any singing or dancing, but it's sort of, it's kind of a dark fairy tale, kind of a gothic ghost story, if you like. So it's in this very intimate space, which is the Stables Theatre, and two actors just take you on this scary thriller journey.
Sounds like something where I'll stop breathing and forget that I haven't breathed for a while and take a huge gasp.
It also features a family, so it's about two parents whose child has disappeared before the play begins, and the first scene is the return of this child. So it opens on a very elated note. The best thing, the most impossible, almost miracle has happened to this couple. And story would end.
Well, exactly. What an interesting idea. You're starting there with the joy of the finding. And do you go backwards or do you...
No, this is... It's actually... I think that's where the nightmare begins, really. So she's back. They've been looking for 9 months. One of them has kind of accepted the fact that they'll never see her again. The other has not given up. And she miraculously comes back with no explanation. And the other thing is she isn't speaking. She is only 5 years old, but she isn't speaking, so they can't find out where she's been or what happened or who brought her back.
So it's all the worry of what was the trauma and what then comes into your mind when you're thinking about that.
Oh, dear.
That's right. And they both go, well, look, who cares? We've got her back. What else could matter? But little by little, that just isn't enough anymore. There's too much unknown, and the mystery of it becomes unbearable for one of them. So it's really kind of a relationship under the microscope as well. And the title refers to... I was sort of inspired by the story of the Snow Queen, where a splinter of glass enters the heart and the eye of this boy, and everything that was once beautiful to him becomes distorted by this glass splinter. But it also is what happens to the marriage, is under this unbearable pressure, it starts to splinter as well.
Gosh, you know how to push these painful points, don't you? Oh, dear. It's funny with kids of that age too. I know from speaking to psychologists and so forth that this is a thing that they can't talk. They are overloaded. And it does happen. I'm gathering that you're getting from the actors that are portraying them, you're getting the pain and the feeling that a parent has for their child when they can't fix something, particularly at that young age.
That's right. And I mean, you know, when you don't, it's sort of like what a great thriller does when there are huge gaps in the information, your mind fills in the blanks. So that's hopefully what happens to the audience, but it's certainly what happens to one of the characters, is the mystery of it. What he conjures in his mind is what might have happened to her is probably far worse than what really did happen to her. But with the absence of knowledge or information or any spoken words from her, he can't help but continually imagine the worst. And in fact, originally, this play was done 7 years ago by the Sydney Theatre Company, and we had a puppet playing the child. And so that was actually where the idea came from, was I thought, well, you know, how am I going to make this puppet child work? Well, what if she can't speak? Actually, that would be really great for the character and for the story. That worked really well.
And but this time you haven't got a puppet. And
no.
So what's the difference this time? Why?
Well, I'm not going to tell you, right? Oh. I'm going to keep it a little bit mysterious.
Oh, okay.
Because there's a big spoiler, and I don't want to give that away.
Oh, certainly not. No, we won't do that.
All I can say is ring Griffin, book a ticket, and you'll find out.
That's right.
And there's something about this play too that's very claustrophobic. So
it's perfect.
Parents, yeah, they take the child down the coast. They have a beach house down the south coast. They just want to get away for 10 days from all the media and the attention and the police questioning, and they think that the best thing for her and for them is just to be able to be together, the three of them. But this isolation actually kind of turns quite hostile and dangerous. So that we're in their little beach house with them for the whole play, and something about being able to see that bank of audience opposite you reflecting back your own reactions creates a terrific sort of tense vortex in a way.
Mm.
It's a gorgeous design. There's going to be some AV, and there's terrific sound. So all of these other elements are coming in together to sort of support the performances.
It's been just wonderful talking to you, Hilary Bell. I really appreciate your
thank
time.
You, Rod. Thank you.
Thank you for your work.
When I know that they've already been answered.
Well, Titus Andronicus is happening with Bell Shakespeare at the moment, getting a lot of rave reviews
mm-hmm.
and interesting feedback. We have one of the stars with us right now, Catherine Van Davies. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Catherine, Titus Andronicus, one of Shakespeare's kind of, well, less performed plays, and some people say a difficult play. What's it about? If you hadn't seen it, what would Titus Andronicus be about?
I think, you know, Titus Andronicus is one of Shakespeare's really early works, and in a way it's less like the later very character, psychologically driven narratives like Hamlet or Macbeth. And stylistically it kind of lends itself more to like a Greek tragedy. In fact, references Ovid's Metamorphoses within the text itself. So ultimately it's this kind of story about these cycles of revenge and violence that happen within not a fictional Rome, but a fictional hierarchy of emperors and whatnot.
And I've seen it. You know, I've seen it described as a gruesome revenge tragedy. How does that gruesomeness manifest on stage?
We took an approach like as theatre makers. We devised work led by Adina, so a lot of the things that you see on stage in our production came out of long-form improvisations and, of course, discussions around the table, but really ultimately what was generated on the floor by every cast member, including the three young people that we have in our cast.
Mm.
The gruesome aspect, I mean, I guess all of us as theatre makers, I'm sure people that have read about the show have read that it's been reimagined through like a queer and a feminist lens, and I think one of those things is not wanting to depict violence in a way that was either gratuitous or lent itself to sort of that pornographic lens as a means of entertainment. But there are themes within the work that I think resonate with today's, particularly the violence in the world, and so we've lent right into the themes. But I think the way in which it's depicted is often stylistic, abstracted, or the feeling that you might get from an image kind of tells you more about what's happening than perhaps the literal reading of the image itself.
Yeah. I have to admit, Catherine, I saw it and I loved it on the opening night.
Oh, great.
And
great.
I love the fact that Titus is played by a woman and those queer aspects that you were talking about. And she is absolutely amazing in the bodysuit that then peels off. And when we are talking about the horror as well, a lot of it was portrayed through makeup, which I thought was really clever. I mean, things like blood and feces and all that sort of stuff. But it was done in this kind of really artistic way. And I almost felt like I was watching an art installation for a lot of it, because it was so artistically done.
Yeah, well, it's Adina and Eugene Tay, who's the designer.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of their work together, I love their work because it blends into that kind of contemporary art practice as well as, you know, theatre making. To me, I don't know why there is such a delineation between the two in our theatres, but yeah, they kind of mix those worlds together and allow an image to kind of to sit there for a long period of time, I think, for people to absorb and lose themselves into.
And Catherine, you play the clown.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and you don't actually speak. It's mainly movement that you do. It's mainly movement based.
Yeah, I've got some lines, but they're very few.
I just
kind of picked up off the floor of other characters, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was an impressive and strange, almost a German impressionistic sort of dance that you do as the clown, which for me actually was the highlight of the show. I really loved it.
Oh, thank you. I had this incredible creative freedom because the clown, you know, on the page exists in one scene, which says a couple of lines and then is hung. Dean and I spoke very early about needing this character that kind of doesn't yet exist on the page, that belongs in this world as a disruptive force, also as a female body in the space that can shadow. Like a lot of the violence actually happens on my body, and there's something about that in displacing the violence, I think, especially off Lavinia, who is a young actor, and also just on to have any one person carrying that on the space just feels not right, I think. And so we wanted to have this other very kind of mobile presence. And, I mean, I even get to kind of scream and rage in the space, which is, I think, how we all felt while we were working with this material.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds absolutely amazing. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Oh, are you seeing it? Oh, fantastic. Yes, You'll love it. You'll really love it.
I am really interested in the aspects because it is a really, like, as you said, it's not a play that is done very often.
No.
And it is also not one that is done with this female and queer perspective. So it's set to be something incredibly different.
It's very exciting. And Catherine, do the school kids come and see it? I know for a lot of Bell they do. Do they come and see this one?
Not this one.
No, I didn't think so.
It's interesting because it's like, you know, in conversations with the young people, and we've got 3 15-year-olds in the show, and they co-authored it. A lot of the work in there that you see on stage is from them. Mm. And, you know, young people are exposed to violence, especially with social media and television and even films. I mean, people watching Tarantino films and whatnot. I don't think that means we should have license to expose them to further violence or trauma. But it is interesting where we choose to censor and protect people, especially when, you know, these young people, I mean, of course the content is full on, but they were so switched on and so up for the conversation, and it was often led by them.
And I think Adina is clever in the way that she, as I said, through the makeup, through puppetry, through film work, through voiceover, more than, as you were saying before, more than just, you know, slash and kill sort of thing. Yeah. It's more clever than that.
Yeah. It was interesting. There's a feedback that I came across. I actually don't read reviews, but I came across a feedback that said that, you know, someone was like, oh, you know, I really enjoyed the acting, but it kind of went beyond entertainment, so we left. And it's, I kind of like, what was it about Tardis and Jonicus that was entertaining? I don't know if we should, you know, find titillation through blood splatter or that kind of expected violence.
Yeah, well, what I found frightening about it was mothers warring, you know, and the revenge and the cycle of revenge that the mothers are involved in with the Queen of the Goths and all that. I found that quite frightening.
I was going to say children slaughtered and baked into pies. That's
exactly.
Tarantino's
illegitimate
got,
children.
Tarantino's got nothing on that.
I know. And it just goes, you know, like it allows it to kind of go deeper into the psychology of all of these cycles of violence because it is mothers you're transferring the stuff onto their children and then, you know, the consumption of their children as well as the protection of their children. And, you know, there's people trying to kind of protect their children by having them back in their bodies versus, you know, involuntarily consuming them. It's, you know, there's all these ideas about what we pass on. And in a way, like, you know, when we retell these stories, what are we passing on?
Yeah.
If we leave them unchecked, you know, or don't give a kind of a new perspective on
and
it.
Having an unknown Shakespeare like this is almost like a blank canvas for the cast and the director to really put their stamp on it, which I think you obviously have done there with Adina.
Yeah, I spoke to one person who they're like, you know, I've seen Titus Andronicus a few times, but I don't think I've actually ever seen Titus Andronicus.
Yeah.
You know, it is one of those plays which many people can have very individual takes on it because it's not historical and it does sit in this kind of world of slightly more of metaphor and poetry.
Well, this version has got everybody talking.
Yep.
Titus Andronicus, Bell Shakespeare is presenting this until 22nd of September.
Oh,
so
my God.
Get out and see
you
it.
Gotta see it. Go see it. Don't take your children. Go and see it.
Yes. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And melt into the nightmare. I think it's so rare to have a theatre experience in which, you know, it's almost you have to kind of leave your cerebral longing to latch onto narrative or something behind and just go with the images, go with
it. Such good advice. Just go with it. I agree. Just let yourself be taken by this production.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine.
Such a pleasure.
And it's time to find out what you have gone to see at the theatre, Patricia. STC Play, I know that you have been looking forward to this since the program came out.
Yes, I have been because I read the book a couple of years ago that Julia wrote and I absolutely loved it.
Alrighty, let's hear what Patricia has to say.
I have been to see the play Avalanche at the Sydney Theatre Company at the Rosalind Packer Theatre. This is written by Julia Lee. Oh, wonderfully acted by the British actor Maxine Peake and gorgeously directed by Anne-Louise Sachs. It really is a woman's world, as the lead character in this play is called The Woman. Now, The Woman is going through a crisis in her life where she wants to suddenly have a marriage and a family. And a lot of those things have escaped her because she's been artistic and she has been pursuing her career. And it's almost that old line of, oh my God, I forgot to have a baby. And here I am pushing 40. Now, this is based on Julia Lee's personal memoir of the same name, Avalanche, which I read 2 years ago and left me in a pool of tears. And I think the book more successfully looked at other issues outside of just being caught up in the IVF cycle after cycle after cycle and being sucked into it by your own desire and your own longing, where I think the book more successfully looked at how life in general can sometimes not be what you expected it to be, that you really push your life along in one way, but then something else happens. And I really love that about the book. Whereas I think in the play, it's so specific that it would be hard to relate to unless you were going through a very similar journey as the woman in this play. I have to say, though, this is amazingly acted, so well directed, and some of the lines are devastatingly beautiful in this play from Julia Lee at the Sydney Theatre Company.
Well, we've come to that time of the night, Trish.
I know. I can't believe it.
So much good theatre to get out and see at the moment.
Yeah, there is. There's so much on. Everywhere.
With special thanks to our fabulous executive producer, Regina Botros, for putting this show together. Speaking of good stuff to go out and see, Don Walker, my favourite songwriter from Cold Chisel, he is playing at the Camelot Lounge tomorrow night, Thursday the 19th, and also Friday the 20th. And quite appropriately, Louis Naur said that this song was the most immediately identifiable song about the cross. It is, of course, Breakfast at Sweetheart's. Get out and see some good stuff.